still evaluate embryos the same way that we did 50 years ago. What we've seen is fast embryos are bad, slow embryos are bad, average embryos are good. We're not genetic testing, we're testing the embryo dynamics as a function of metabolism on those embryos. And then we use a machine learning analysis on these embryos because it's our goal to predict embryos that make babies, not even pregnancies. Like, we want to make babies.
Welcome back to Healthy as a Mother. I am your co-host, Dr. Leah Gordon, and this is the show for becoming and being a mother, where Dr. Morgan and I share the natural women's health and motherhood guidance you've been looking for through a fresh, functional, and balanced lens. Today, I'm so excited to welcome my guest, Dr. Kara. She is a PhD and the founder of an amazing company that has created a technology to understand the quality of embryos used in IVF. Now, they have been doing a lot of work in the animal world, but they are moving into the human world, and it's a fascinating conversation where we talk about IVF and embryo quality, egg and sperm quality, and even endangered species, and how all of these different things that we're learning about animals impact fertility, and also how their company can be used to support us not only on the animal side, but on the human side. And she tells this really crazy story about rhinos, and it was a really cool episode. So without further ado, let's get started. Okay, I am so excited for you to be on the podcast, Kara. Will you tell everybody a little bit about your background? And you're a PhD, but just tell me kind of where you come from, what got you started, and we're going to be diving into your technology that you created that could be potentially useful with IVF, but tell us just a little bit about your story and how you got there.
Thanks. Yeah, super excited to be here today. So I'm Kara Wells. I'm originally from the Houston, Texas area, and my parents are both oil and gas engineers. I lived in the suburbs, but randomly, I tell this because I think it's an important part of my story. When I was probably about 8 years old, I fell in love with horses. And I just thought they were super majestic. I thought they were amazing animals. And I wanted to learn how to ride them and learn everything about them. And I was persistent as a child. So after taking riding lessons, one day of horses a week was just not enough. And so my parents ended up buying me a horse, which really spurred a lifelong love of horses and animals. And I thought that I would pursue a career with them one day. Mm-hmm. I like science. I like biology. And so I thought being a veterinarian would be the natural route for my career progression. And so I went to Texas Tech University to study animal science in 2009. Getting into vet school was really competitive. And so I was doing all the things that a young student does to make themselves stand out on that application. And one of the unique tracks that I fell into was undergraduate research. Mm-hmm. And I went to the first lab that was accepting undergraduates, which was actually a reproductive physiology lab. And cool. As an undergraduate, I got put on a project studying embryos. I found out as an undergraduate that IVF was becoming more of a common way for people to build their families, as well as a common way for animal breeders to accelerate genetic progress and use this as a way to breed their animals. And that these processes have been going on for about 50 plus years, especially on the animal side. But we still evaluate embryos the same way that we did 50 years ago, which mm-hmm. is just the embryologist looking at the embryos under a microscope and grading them based off of visually apparent characteristics. So mm-hmm. I was put on a project as an undergraduate looking at new embryo evaluation and selection techniques. I ended up loving it so much that I decided to stay on and get a PhD in reproductive physiology, which I did. I completed in 2017. And then I moved to the Austin, Texas area because my husband was gainfully employed and I wasn't. So it brought us out here west of Austin. And my first job outside of grad school was working at a human IVF clinic in Austin, Texas. Mm. And it's meaningful work, but I just couldn't let go of some of the problems in this industry. And my core expertise was embryo evaluation, so I went there. And I really just felt that it was important to find new objective, non-invasive, quantitative ways to evaluate embryos to help clinicians and patients be more informed of their embryo's health when they go into this process, help them pick the healthiest embryos that's going to get them pregnant on the first transfer attempt. Mm-hmm. And so I left my job to embark on a career as an entrepreneur.
Oh my gosh, that's such a cool story. I love that. And for anyone who doesn't know, I mean, obviously none of you know, but my husband met you through a startup funding thing, I believe. I think BioTools or something like that. Yeah. And we were so excited. I remember him coming home and he's like, oh my gosh, there's this amazing girl and she's doing this amazing thing and it's in the IVF space. And, you know, that's so near and dear to our hearts since we had our children via IVF. And so we actually ended up investing in your company and we're just so excited for what it's going to become. But it's so cool because I haven't actually sat down and talked to you one-on-one yet until now. So this is so fun for me to learn about you as well. And I just love the passion and where our stories lead us and how entrepreneurs are so cool and taking a problem that they see in the world or a passion that they have or a hardship that they've gone through or whatever and turn it into something to make the world a better place. And so I'm just so stoked that you did that. And what a fascinating thing. I've had one embryologist on the podcast many, many seasons ago. And I think it's such a black box, like IVF in general to most people who haven't had to go through that feels very confusing and mysterious. But then once you are a person who's struggling with infertility and you're going down this route, it can feel very confusing. And then the embryology side is even more mysterious and more black box. And you don't even like, I remember walking past the embryology clinic at my, or the embryology lab at my clinic and just being like, what is happening in there? Like you are you picking like my child and like what is all in your hands? What if you had a bad night last night and you're kind of hungover? Like, are you gonna, you know, I just had all these like spiraling thoughts that I don't know even how much of my future is in your hands. I don't even know. Like, is it nothing? Is it all of it? And I remember just feeling very confused and wanting to understand more about the embryology side. And so I'm just so fascinated to pick your brain, not only because of the knowledge that you have, but also this new technology that you've made that could potentially help outcomes. And so anyways, why don't you explain a little bit about what it is that you have created and what you saw the need to create in the first place?
Sure. Great question. So we, like I said, I really wanted to create a non-invasive, quantitative, objective technique to evaluate that embryo's health, which sounds great, but I mean, how in the world do we do that? And how in the world do we do that in a way that fits into the workflow of that IVF lab? I mean, these labs are dealing with a lot of embryos, a lot of patients. And so they don't have a lot of extra time to tack on to each embryo. And so I realized as an entrepreneur that science and accuracy is great, but it's all meaningless if we can't actually get it to work into the workflow of these IVF labs where mm-hmm. our customers work. And so I spent 7 years on my PhD creating an academic innovation that was scientifically sound, but it didn't meet the workflow. My PhD research, we actually filled a clear straw with mm-hmm. culture media, and with a pipette, we would drop the embryos down the straw, let them descend 1 centimeter, and time the rate of descent. And what we ended up finding is that the embryos like that sank like a stone were actually not viable. And wow. The embryos that were able to sort of like slowly descend through the chamber were the embryos that were alive and healthy because they still had the protein integrity in their cells to osmoregulate their environment, not let water rush into those cells.
Amazing.
And I thought this was amazing, but no one has the time to drop embryos one by one down a fluid-filled chamber and time how long it takes for them to descend.
And I'm assuming that this research was being done with animal embryos because of so many, like, that you would need.
In grad school, I worked mostly first with mice and then actually with sheep and cattle. Mm-hmm. And the sheep and cattle kind of sidebar here was a fun part of me becoming an entrepreneur. So these sheep and cattle that I worked on in grad school, these were not research-funded embryo studies through the institution. These were my friends' animals that I was friends with in the animal science department. Yeah. And they're like, hey, what you're working on is really cool. Our vet is coming out to transfer some embryos on Tuesday. Do you want to come out and use your little device on them and we can see the results and we'll get you the pregnancy outcomes on that? Wow. And that wasn't just my friends being nice to me. That was them saying that there are real problems in this industry. They want technologies to work. And so they were willing to invest their own animals and risk their own animals for an experiment because they want technologies to predict better embryos in the future. And so that was kind of my first realization that there might be a market opportunity commercially for products to evaluate embryo health. But unfortunately, that project ended up stalling just because it was too cumbersome. It was too labor intensive for these labs. And so I was defeated for a while. That was a hard and humbling moment. But at the same time, I was like, okay, like we've done this once when we were an undergraduate and we had less industry knowledge and embryo expertise. How do we do it again in a way that it fits into the workflow? And I got really lucky that I randomly stumbled upon a TED Talk in 2020, which had nothing to do with embryos, nothing to do with reproduction. It was a technology that came out of MIT called video motion magnification. Mm-hmm. And it was a video filter that amplified micromotions embedded in video data. So the example in the TED Talk that resonated with me is they took a video of a man's face. He was sitting in front of the camera very still. Mm-hmm. He looked normal. But when you use this filter on him, you can see his skin turn red and blue as his blood became oxygenated and deoxygenated, which is not something that I can see looking at you right now.
Right.
So I was like, this is super cool. If an embryo is a living, growing organism, their cells are dividing, they're differentiating into different cell types, they're using energy, they're doing all these dynamic processes, but it's not something that my human eye can see as an embryologist, but perhaps computers and technology can see these dynamic processes. So I thought that was sort of the origin story of my company ImGenesis for what inspired doing a real-time video analysis on the embryos. Mm-hmm. And so after I saw that TED Talk, I had to prove it. I didn't exactly have embryos, you know, in my home. And so I partnered with a cattle veterinarian in Texas, and his job, he does conventional embryo transfer. So, these embryos are actually fertilized in vivo. The animals are artificially inseminated, and then 7 days later, embryos are fleshed from their uterus. And so he did that embryo collection on them. He took 30-second videos on the embryos. I purchased the filter from MIT, and some of them moved, and some of them didn't. This was April 2020. We had no idea if movement was a good thing or a bad thing. So he went ahead and transferred each embryo individually into a different recipient animal or surrogate. And 35 days later, we had some pregnancy results on those embryos. And we found out with the embryos with the high and low activity did not make pregnancies. And the ones with more average activity did make pregnancies. So
cool.
Our minds were like, okay, we might really be onto something. And with new advancements in computer technologies, machine learning, artificial intelligence, we can probably create some type of non-invasive video-based analysis. Mm-hmm. So today, our product is software only. And we allow people to leverage the hardware, so the microscopes and the cameras that they already own. We recommend people use just a smartphone camera mounted over the lens of their microscope. They take a 30-second video of these embryos. And then we've collected data on over 60,000 cattle embryos, where we train machine learning models based on actual pregnancy outcomes of which embryos are good enough to make pregnancies that stick and survive to term, and which embryos do not make pregnancies or end in early embryo loss or miscarriage, if you will. And we've been able to translate this into several different species now, both animal species, and we're working with about 5 different human IVF labs to validate the data for use in humans. And we use a brand name called Viable Biosciences to market that product.
Oh my gosh, how cool. I just feel like it's such a beautiful gift. And I use this analogy a lot because I think it's kind of hard for some people to understand the use of IVF. You know, I was raised Catholic and I remember seeing signs of like test tube babies and this is evil and don't do it. And, you know, all of these horrible things. And I remember as a kid being like, oh my God, you know, and then I always had this inkling inside of me. I remember I watched the movie Juno and if anyone's ever seen that, you know, the teenage girl gets pregnant really young and there's this family who really desperately wants a baby and they're going to be adopting this baby. And I remember as a young person thinking like, that would be the worst thing ever. Like, could you imagine having a love and being in a marriage and not being able to have your own children and like the torment that she went through and all of that. And it's just so ironic that that's literally what happened, that I grew up and was not able to get pregnant with my amazing husband who I loved so much. And, you know, it took me a really long time to wrap my head around the fact that we were going to have to do IVF to have a family because of severe male factor infertility. And I had a lot of my own like moral grappling conflicts and all sorts of things, being a naturopathic doctor, being like, I failed, I couldn't figure this out. If we can't get pregnant on our own, it's not meant to be. You know, I've spiraled down all these places. But then when I found peace with it, Mike has told me this multiple times, and it's an analogy that I've shared on the podcast before. It's not an analogy, but like a fable. I don't even know. And I totally butcher it. But basically it goes, there's a man and it's flooding and the water is rising up and he's climbed on top of his roof and he's praying to God and he's saying, please save me, God. He's like, I don't want to die. Please save me. And a boat comes by and it says, jump into our boat. And he's like, no, I'm praying to God. God's going to save me. So I'm praying to God. He's going to save me. And then a helicopter comes and they say, jump in our helicopter. And he's like, nope, I'm praying to God. God's going to save me. He's not going to let me die. And the water rises and rises and he drowns and he dies and he goes to heaven. And he says, God, what are you doing? You'd never saved me. I prayed to you and you didn't save me. He's like, I sent you a boat and a helicopter. And I feel like this sort of is where I'm at with IVF, where there is a huge fertility and infertility crisis happening. I'm going to call it a crisis. Like, it's not even like mild. It's a big deal. And, you know, I do everything I can as a natural fertility doctor to optimize health as much as possible so that people can get pregnant on their own naturally. But there are so many things that we are up against in this new world that we live in, from toxins and stress and technology that is affecting us. Like, there's so many things that, you know, some people see IVF as like, don't ever do it. Like, it's not natural or whatever. But at the same time, it's like, or is it a gift from God that it's like, this is literally like, I make you cry, but every time I look at my children, I'm like, you are the biggest blessing and you literally wouldn't be here without IVF. And, you know, I have patients, like I have one just that I'm seeing this week who went through IVF and her embryo failed, you know? And it's like the loss of that, it's just so sad. And so if there is a technology like yours that could change that outcome, even just, you know, not, I don't want to say a little bit, but it's like if you could, you know, pick an embryo that would survive and you don't go through the loss and all of the medication stress and all the things that people have to do, like she's going to have to go through the whole process again of more injections and all of that because, you know, of different things. And so I just see people like you and the companies that you're making and the technology as like a gift, right, from God or whoever, that maybe this is actually allowing us to have what we need. And I don't know, I just wanted to share that for people who are thinking, because you're a scientist, I'm a scientist too, and we can go so into this, like just grading embryos and seeing what works and doesn't work. But then if we translate it into what does that actually mean for our world and for people, I just think it's so powerful and so such a blessing. So I'm so happy you made this company.
That's probably the biggest compliment that I've ever received in my entire life. So thank you so much for that. And absolutely. I mean, I'm a scientist, and it's easy to get caught up in the product and the embryos. But I mean, the real goal for this company was to make an impact and to help improve the world through what my expertise is, and that's embryos and embryo evaluation. And I have bigger goals for this company than what it is today. Like right now, we're essentially just ranking the embryos that are available from healthiest to least healthy. And so you can pick the best embryo first for transfer, or if there's, you know, unfortunately the situation where none of the embryos are high quality as evaluated through our system, it at least gives people realistic expectations for how to move forward. Do they want to move towards like donor egg, donor sperm, or do they want to do a lifestyle reset and try to get healthy and come back and try again? But my other goal for this company is to really empower people with data. It is so hard to validate what is a good embryo today. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't really do that in a lot of ways without killing them, right, or really expensive procedures. And so I think that you know, different experiments can be done, if you will, from diet, nutrition, lifestyle factors, different STEM protocols, you know, everything that goes in upstream to creating those embryos. And if we can give quicker feedback to which protocols, which processes work, then instead of just being a selection device where we help select the healthiest embryos, we can be a consultant for how to make all the embryos more healthy going forward. And that's something that I'm really personally really excited about.
That's so cool. Yeah, let's talk about that. You had mentioned offline a little bit about how you can tell mitochondrial health or egg health or maybe sperm health. Can you dive into that? Because currently it's really hard for us to be able to know and understand what that is. It is so archaic what we're dealing with here.
Exactly. So we are the only technology that looks at real-time embryo dynamics. So we take 30-second videos of these embryos, and we can do different computerized processes on them where we can see their activity frame by frame, which would be cellular activity. And so if we reverse engineer what is cellular activity, I really believe that it comes down to embryo metabolism. So why are these cells moving in real time? Because a 30-second window, it's not enough time to see like a full division cycle like the time-lapse imaging companies are doing. So we're seeing some type of real-time dynamics, and I really believe that that's metabolism. And the embryos at this pre-implantation stage, they're going through one of the most rapid growth cycles that they will ever do in their entire life, going from one cell, two cell, four cell, 300 cell, all the way to a fetus and then a baby. And from a metabolic level, what we've seen is fast embryos are bad, slow embryos are bad, average embryos are good. Wow. So I believe that the fast embryos, and these look beautiful, they're forming these nice big expanded blastocysts, they're reaching their developmental milestones, but I believe that they're using energy so fast that they're growing at a rate that cannot sustain with life, and they're burning themselves out. They might make a pretty transferable embryo, they might even make a pregnancy, but a lot of times we're seeing that these embryos don't actually stick. They result in miscarriage, and that's actually a more devastating process for everybody than the embryo just not making a pregnancy at all. On the slow side, these embryos aren't using activity. They're on the way out the door already. They're not developing like they should. They're never going to catch up. And they might look normal and healthy today. But I think about it, like if I were to go outside right now and pull a leaf off of a tree, morphologically, it's still going to be green. It's going to have the same texture as it did when it was alive and on the tree. But the second that I removed it from that stem, it's starting to die. And it might take 12 hours, maybe even 24 hours for it to turn brown, turn crispy, show me those visual signs of embryo death. And so embryos are the same way. Just by looking at them, the onset of death could have happened hours ago, but the symptoms just are not there yet. And so by looking at embryo activity and selecting the ones with more average activity, I think those are the ones that are being responsible with their energy resources. Slow and steady wins the race. And trying to figure out what factors reach or which factors in the lifestyle of these adult animals or people create these metabolically responsible cells, I think is what creates healthy embryos, which creates babies. We've done a ton of work on the animal side, and I love that we went to the animal side first. There's a great market need. We can do a lot of things for like food production with this side, but what I think is really applicable to the human IVF side is we don't do IVF in animals to treat infertility. We do IVF in animals because their genetics are so good, we want to perpetuate more of them. So this might be an animal that doesn't have to eat a lot of feed, but still grows really fast to make more beef or makes more milk. And so we call that, you know, feed efficient. It's more sustainable to produce animals like that. Or maybe they're really healthy or have good feet and good bone conformation to where they don't have health problems, which means that they're going to thrive in our production environment and not need antibiotic treatment or a lot of veterinary care. And so when we select these embryos, so when we select the donors to go through the IVF process on both the male and the female side, we're selecting the healthiest animals of their species. They're typically young. They're typically on a really, like these animals literally have nutritionists. They're on a really structured diet. They live in a regimented way. So, I mean, we really cut out a lot of the variables doing this in animals that that we would see in humans. So looking at these pretty uniform populations, we really got to see what healthy embryos look like, free from all the variables that are present in people. Like, I know that cow never smoked. I know that she never went to the bar too much. So I think it's been really special that we were able to collect all this data in animals. So we really understood in this uniform population what a healthy embryo looked like. And so on the flip side, in humans, people don't go through IVF because it's fun. They're typically doing it because they're using it as a treatment for infertility. So there's usually some type of pathology that's present. And so because we know normal from our embryo models in animals, it's easier for us to detect normal and abnormal when we apply this to people.
And now a quick word from our sponsor. We've partnered with Needed to bring you this episode. Stress is something that many people can experience along the fertility journey, and it's something that influences how they handle oxidative damage. That's why supporting overall cellular health can be super valuable at any stage along the fertility journey. One product I personally love recommending is Needed's A Quality Support. I helped contribute to formulating this product, but even if I hadn't, I would still be confident recommending it because it's so great. It's designed to provide antioxidant and mitochondrial support with ingredients like L-carnitine, green tea extract, ALA, and PQQ. I also love pairing it with Needed's comprehensive prenatal and their CoQ10 for a comprehensive approach. Visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Okay, back to the show.
So cool. I would love, and maybe you have this on your docket to do, but
I would love to see studies where you start evaluating human embryos, but then there's a whole, you know, evaluation of that woman or that couple and what their lifestyle is like and what their health is like. We obviously know this, like in the naturopathic medicine world, what is good for mitochondrial health and what is going to be optimal for fertility, but it's so hard to do that data and, you know, or have that robust literature to back it up, because studying things in animals, like you said, it's so easy. Or even doing sperm evaluation is so easy. You know, it's so easy to get sperm from a guy and just test it and be like, okay, now stop smoking and now stop doing sauna and now eat better. And then we're going to see in real time how the sperm changes. It's almost impossible to see that in women because we don't extract eggs and look at them under a microscope, you know, like we do with sperm. But IVF does give us such a powerful tool to do these kind of studies where we can start understanding what it does take to change outcomes and maybe even change outcomes in a person who comes in and has a certain situation. Like you said, I've had patients who they've gone through IVF, all of their embryos are euploid, or like they're not healthy. Like they all have chromosomal abnormalities. And then they'll work with me, you know, for 6 months, we get both of them really healthy. They'll go back through IVF and their outcomes are completely different, you know, and then they have healthy embryos and they transfer and have a pregnancy. And I know that because I work with them, but there's so little data. But with IVF, we could get that data, and you could play such a pivotal role in that, of really highlighting what is so important for us to be doing from a lifestyle and, you know, holistic perspective in both partners. And before you chime in, because I know you probably have a lot to say, I just want to highlight, I was at a conference when I was a student, and my dad's a vet. He's a large animal vet as well. So he, you know, worked with cows, and we have ranches. We raise cattle and do all of that as well. I don't think my parents do IVF. They do natural breeding, but I am so fascinated to learn more about that offline. I think it's so cool. But I remember going to this conference and this veterinarian came up. It was a naturopathic or nutrition conference. And he told me, he says, you know, everything we know about nutrition, we learned from the vet world. And I was like, really? I was like, tell me more. And he's like this old vet, and he was so cute. And he was telling us that in the animal world, we want healthy animals. Like, you want your animals, especially if you're raising animals like for beef or poultry, for chicken, to be healthy, because it is financially irresponsible to have unhealthy animals. Whereas in human medicine, there is a lot of financial pull to not be healthy, because a lot of the medical industry makes money off of disease and illness. And so there is not a financial incentive for there to be adequately healthy food and to catch diseases early and prevent diseases and have, you know, so much lifestyle emphasis, because they don't make money on that. They make money on disease and medications and procedures. And it's not like everybody in the system is evil, but that's just kind of how it's set up because of how financials work. And because the animal world benefits so much from having healthy animals, they are financially invested in actually creating health. So they are the ones that end up having supplements and nutritional education and research on, oh, what actually makes an animal healthy? And so much of what we know in the nutrition world and in the wellness world actually comes from the animal world, which I think is so fascinating. And it was such an eye-opener for me. And it felt cool to like take that home and talk to my dad about it, because it was just, I had never understood how intimately connected studying and supporting the animal world was for human wellness. So I just wanted to like highlight that.
I know, as an animal scientist, I feel like you're doing a great job advocating right now. And yeah, I mean, that's our goal, is to produce healthy animals. And we study it because, I mean, anything that you change on those animals that creates one more pound or one less pound of beef can have, you know, very significant financial consequences. And so they're studied, and sick animals don't grow. So we need healthy animals. And yeah, we've
sick
learned
animals
so much
don't
from
reproduce,
them.
Right? Like sick
don't.
Animals don't
exactly.
reproduce. So there's a financial benefit to have optimal fertility, right? In animals.
100%. Yeah.
That's so cool. So going back to like egg and sperm, is there anything else that you guys have learned or that you feel like you could potentially play a role in understanding in that spectrum or world for human IVF or human fertility?
Yeah. So, I mean, all of the above. I mean, I think that embryo health, egg health, sperm health, it's always changing. It's biology. It's a reflection of, you know, that animal's or that human's health. A really interesting study that we did. So I save all of our videos indefinitely because retrospectively, there's so many interesting things that we can go back and look at, especially when we get more data down the line, like did these embryos make pregnancies? Did they result in abortions? Did they create, you know, a dead on arrival animal, like a genetic defect, all these things. And so one of the studies that I did, which was really fun, and we published this at a conference, is I was working with a dairy that did a couple hundred embryo transfers a week, and they used the same bulls over and over. This was a high genomic Holstein situation, so really high genetic Holstein bulls were used to be the paternal side of these embryos. We actually didn't get to look at the embryos until they were about 7 days old when they arrived on site at the heifer yard for transfer. So I don't actually have images or anything prior to that 7 day embryo that we were able to collect videos of. And the way animal IVF works a lot of times is the embryos are made at an IVF lab and then they're shipped to the farm where the local vet will come and transfer them. Mm-hmm. The labs are only going to ship like the good embryos, you know, the morphologically normal ones. So there'd already been some pre-selecting by the time we got our hands on these embryos. They all looked great morphologically. We put them through our system and then we were able to track these embryos' development through ultrasound at about 35, 60, and 180 days post-transfer. Mm-hmm. And we decided to do a sire study because we had, say, 10 sires, so the bulls, mm-hmm. that had each fathered, if you will, probably more than 100 embryos each that we had data on. So mm-hmm. as a scientist, I'm like, that's a pretty good sample size. Let's see if there's any impacts here. There was this one bull. He made pretty embryos, but our system was detecting it as low quality embryos, even though morphologically they were normal. This bull had an 8% pregnancy rate. Whoa. And so we were like, wow, like that's really costly to the person who's paying to do IVF on all these animals. The great thing about, you know, sperm is it's constantly being, you know, regenerated. And so if you make some type of like change for this animal, 90 days later, his sperm can be, you know, a completely different sample and much more improved. And so it was crazy that even in these 7 day embryos, we found that this one bull made embryos with compromised embryo quality that was detectable through our system. And we were able to go back, identify that bull, and then make recommendations for how he could improve his fertility. And this is a multi-million dollar bull. So the wow. owners were absolutely incentivized to make sure that they did everything that they could to keep him as a breeding prospect.
Wow. And were you able to follow up on that? Are there any changes that they could have made to improve the outcome? Or is that not something, I know that's like a whole long-term thing to follow, or like, I don't even know what you would make recommendations on. They're definitely not, you know, using their cell phones and going into the sauna and doing the things that adult human men do. But like, are there supplements or different things that could improve sperm quality in animals? It's such a fascinating thing.
There are. And a big thing that we look at in the US and, you know, globally right now is heat stress. So how do we mitigate heat stress on these animals? And so that can be husbandry things like shade and fans. But there's also a lot of like heat stress supplements on the market that increase like vasodilation to allow more heat to escape the body. And even some really cool technologies or products that have a pheromonal effect to reduce stress, which also has a good impact on heat stress. But yeah, I'm not actually sure what like his specific diagnosis was, but I know that mitigating heat stress is something that is a big problem in the U.S. animal production right now. It's definitely being prioritized. And actually, we see differences in embryos in winter months versus summer months, which I think the heat stress is definitely coming up in our analysis.
That's so crazy. So I know in the human side, mitochondrial health, which are the energy powerhouses essentially of the cells, are so important. And a lot of the things that we recommend from a supplement perspective tend to support the mitochondria, as well as lifestyle things like CoQ10 and other stuff like that. Do you guys do similar things in the animal world to support mitochondria, or is it not necessarily a big focus because the animals don't have as much mitochondrial damage because they're just not exposed to things? Even though I wonder about this, where herbicides and pesticides impact humans and animals are grazing on grass that's often sprayed with herbicides and pesticides, I've always wondered if that has impacted their fertility or their health at all.
I do know a lot of people who give CoQ10, so that's definitely really used on the animal side. I mean, supplementation is huge. Like I said, a lot of these animals like literally have nutritionists. Purina is a multi-billion dollar company, and they have a lot of, you know, staff scientists, and there's a lot of, you know, nutrition companies. I do think it's important, though, to remember that when we're breeding these animals, they're probably about 2 to 6 years old. And so they're a lot younger with a lot less exposure than a 30-something, 40-something-year-old IVF patient. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, you know, if these environmental toxins, compounds, practices are having a negative impact on that animal's ability to reproduce, that's affecting that rancher, that farmer's next season, and both their bottom line and their top line. So they're absolutely trying to figure out, if they had low pregnancy rates, what can they give these animals to prevent that from ever happening again?
Yeah, that's so cool. I just think it's so fascinating. And I know that like the work you're doing is going to be so impactful for humans, and you're doing so much in the animal space. Can you speak a little bit about, just because I'm fascinated, whether people like are interested or not, I think it's so interesting, on how this can impact and improve animal outcomes, not only on just, you know, making healthier animals, but I know my husband had mentioned that you guys are doing stuff with endangered species, and just like, can you speak a little bit about some of these other things that you guys are able to help with? Because I think that's so cool.
Sure. I mean, I really believe that species have their differences, and I love reproduction, or weird reproduction. Like, I think it's so fun when you find that like weird oddball species, like a clownfish, that can like literally switch sexes when it needs to for reproduction purposes. But I mean, generally, I believe that mammalian embryos develop very similar. I mean, they have their quirks, they have their baselines, but I really believe that an embryo is an embryo, and we can't treat them protocol-wise. It's like one size fits all. But I really believe in like translational sciences, and that we can learn and apply things from one species to another. Mm-hmm. I talked about mgenesis allowing quantitative validation of that embryo's health, which is really something that is rarely done because embryos are very fragile. There's not that many things that we can do to them that doesn't kill them. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that we have a non-invasive and quantitative analysis can really help give a lot of data, especially in a world like conservation, where the sample sizes that we have to work with are very small. They try to be as least manipulative as possible to these embryos, because if they kill those embryos, that might mean that, you know, your children never get to see a rhinoceros. Mm-hmm. And so it's been really fun to take this technology out of like the more mainstream commercial uses like domestic livestock and human IVF and go to the San Diego Zoo and say, hey, we have this technology. I know you have microscopes and cameras. If you can take a video of those rhinoceros or big cat or whatever type of embryos that they might be working with in the lab that day, we'll analyze them frame by frame. We might not know what it means, but we'll give you the data. And if that can result in less troubleshooting for how to grow these embryos in an in vitro environment, then that could be the difference between, you know, these animals being on our planet for generations to come or being extinct for forever. Wow. And then, you know, that translational side. So a really cool project that I got to do is we actually worked with some videos of both a northern and a southern white rhino embryos. And the horse is the closest living relative to the rhinoceros. We had several horse embryos that we've analyzed through our system. And so we actually compared like some of the different baselines and the differences between horses and the rhinoceros. And they performed differently. But I mean, that was the best that we had to go with. And we were able to give data and consult the zoo on how these embryos developed in real time, which can potentially help detect challenges in their process. Like what if one day that embryo's activity spiked because they changed culture media and it was too rich of an environment for those embryos? Because we don't know the best culture media to put a rhinoceros embryo in. It's not like we've tested it thousands of times like we've done in other animals. Mm-hmm. And so if we can see that spike, maybe they could recover that embryo, put it back in the old culture media, and it will resume its development as normal. So it's just been really fun to have an impact on so many things that's bigger than ourselves and do it with the technology that we've been able to create, kind of like a platform technology that's very versatile for different species.
Did you know proper hydration and mineral balance are key for hormone health, fertility, and preparing for pregnancy? This is why Dr. Morgan and I love Relight by Redmond's, the real salt people. A USA-made electrolyte powder with unrefined sea salt, over 60 trace minerals, plus bioavailable forms of potassium, calcium, and two forms of magnesium, malate and glycinate. These minerals support hormones, hydration, energy, and overall health. The best part is they taste delicious. I'm really picky about how things taste, and so you can rest assured this is Dr. Leah approved. I love lemon lime, but I know Dr. Morgan is a strawberry lemonade gal. Head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% off your order of electrolytes, real sea salt, natural toothpaste, and so much more. Again, head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15%. Happy hydrating on your womanhood and fertility journey. That's so cool. My daughter is really into this show called Wildcrats, and it's like a really cool show. If anyone's looking for a cute show for their kids, it's on PBS Kids, but it's two zoologists and it's their brothers, and they go around to different parts of the world and teach about the animals, but then they turn into cartoon versions of themselves and have little adventures within the animal world. But you learn so much about the animals, and it's so fascinating. And you know, they've brought up a couple of the endangered species. And I just think that it's so cool because, like I had mentioned with the analogy of, you know, getting gifts, you know, from God or whoever to combat what we are currently dealing with, like not only is human fertility in a crisis, there are a lot of animal species that are literally disappearing because mostly of us, like as humans, we're doing most of this, you know, downfall. But then we need to have solutions to fix what has happened that maybe in hindsight we didn't realize was so impactful, you know, like how we're sort of poisoning everything, and you know, animals are really struggling like around the globe. So it's not, you know, for me, I see fertility as not, we can zoom in on a micro level of a person, right? To me, your fertility is a sign of health. What is going on with you? then you put two partners together and there's like that complex health together of how you create this human being. And there's all of these deeper meanings as to like why we should have children, even though people, you know, will argue against that. And it's like, there's just so many things that I think are important and what that means. But if we zoom out, our fertility and the impact that we have and why our fertility is so stressed out, it's like Mother Nature is angry, right? Like we are not doing things in an appropriate way to cultivate thriving for us or for the animals that share this planet with us. And so, you know, there's a huge need, and hopefully with my husband eventually selling his company, we'll have the resources to be able to dive into solving more of these really big problems that take a lot of money that don't necessarily result in a lot of income for people, to solve some of these problems that I feel really passionate about on a macro level. You know, even though I work in the micro with patients, it's like there's a bigger macro problem. And I just think that that's amazing that you kind of are working on that at multiple levels as well. Like you're in the teeny tiny world of the embryo in a lab, but you're also potentially impacting like, you know, the health of potentially an entire species. So I just think that's so cool.
It's like one of my fun facts, like one of my favorite projects. And there's not money in it, but I mean, there's impact and it's
amazing. That's what I'm saying. It's cool.
And I mean, the scientists that some of these zoos employ, I've learned so much about them. They have the coolest job in the entire world. And I mean, I think it's really applicable. And to human health as well. Like one of my favorite studies, which I think is super interesting, is rhinoceros that were captured from the wild, bred just fine in zoos. They reproduced just fine, gave birth to live calves. But those calves that were conceived in zoos, they weren't able to reproduce. And what someone found is that in zoos, the mother rhinos, while pregnant, so when that baby was in utero, they were feeding them alfalfa. Alfalfa, it's a legume, and it has a high phytoestrogen content. Well, that phytoestrogen was binding to the receptors of that fetus. And so when that fetus matured, hit puberty, and was at a sexually reproductive age, she didn't, you know, react to her own estrous cycle and her own hormones because her estrogen receptor had been overstimulated. So they're like, oh my gosh, like we need to change their diet right now. And they did. And then rhinoceros were able to reproduce in zoos again. So, oh, I mean, it's just amazing. Like this is totally stuff that you talk about all the time, but
that was the coolest thing you've ever told me, first of all, because I'm like, why are vets and doctors not literally sitting together every single day and talking? Because this is what's happening in humans. You know, we, our generation, the millennials, are at the age of trying to reproduce, and we were sort of the experiment of having mothers who were engrossed in a toxic soup when we were babies, when they were pregnant with us back in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And we are now seeing the same effects, that reproductive phytoestrogen or testosterone, like things like phthalates. Phthalates come from soft plastics. They're in a lot of fragranced items, you know, air fresheners, fragrance laundry. They mimic testosterone or they block testosterone. They basically like block your own testosterone ability. So like boys who were exposed in utero to a lot of phthalates when they were little babies are growing up now, and they don't even know that some of their reproduction could have been impacted that happened when they were in utero and they're in their 30s, you know, trying to have babies. Or, you know, we see PCOS in women, and so many of it is from toxin exposure in utero, but it's like, we wouldn't know that. Like, you could know that data so much faster in the animal world, like you just shared, and because their reproductive cycle is shorter. And you can learn these things, and like just like that tweak of understanding and knowing that something that's happening in utero is impacting their reproduction, we are taking way too long in the human world to be like, oh my gosh, I wonder if something happened 30 years ago. It's like, you guys, we need to be faster. Like, look to the animal model. I just think that is so powerful, because we know that, like, inherently sort of in my world, but in the conventional world, that is very not a known thing. And the fact that there's still fragrances everywhere and that we are not, you know, warning pregnant women against that, just like we do about deli meat. I'm just like, this is important, you know? So I just think that's so cool that in the animal world, it all makes sense. It's just translating it to the human world. It's like, come on, people, get with the program.
But I mean, we're all mammals. Our bodies work very similar at, you know, the molecular level. And yeah, I think that when we share information, it can have a really beneficial impact. You know, human health can learn from animal health, but I think we can go the other way as well. And
I know.
It's good for everyone.
That's so cool. I have one more thing to say, and then I have one more question. I remember, so I was at Christmas this winter, and my dad is wicked smart. He, even still, I'm just like, okay, you were a vet 1,000 years ago. And I, you know, I'm not that far out. I mean, I graduated in 2017. And so, you know, I'm closer to the knowledge of learning things, but he remembers things and he just knows stuff. But it's so funny because I was working with a patient, you know, working from home when I was there for Christmas in Colorado. And I was talking and explaining to my sister about PCOS and some other conditions because she was asking about herself. And my dad chimes in, like randomly. He knows I work in women's health and infertility and hormones. And I've literally never heard him talk about this, about animals. And he's like, oh yeah, I used to love, you know, animal reproduction. I used to want to go into that. And he was talking about how animals get PCOS and all of this stuff. And I was like, stop. I like literally was like, no way. I did not know this. Like, I did not know that animals had these things that I thought were so unique to humans, especially that seemed to have a lifestyle piece and factor. And I wanted to understand it more and was just like, what? Like, why are we not learning more from these animal models? This is crazy. And it blew my mind. That sounds maybe silly to some people, but I just didn't realize that there were so many similarities in disease processes and imbalances.
There are, one of the coolest things that I've ever been able to help someone with was just with a friend, and she had adult twin children, one boy, one girl. The boy, very healthy, thin, athletic, and the girl has had obesity since she was about 6 months old. They said that she blew up and had like moon face, and that, you know, my friend, the mother, she fed her children the same thing. And she took her daughter to all types of like doctors and endocrinologists, and they never really figured out like what was wrong with her. That's just how she was. And then come to find out, you know, as an adult, she has PCOS. And being a problem solver and just loving to think through these situations, my mind immediately went to a problem in cattle, which we call free Martins. And I'm sure your dad knows exactly what this is.
I'm sure he does. I'm sure he does.
It's where a bull and a heifer, twins, share a placenta. And so the male's hormones cross over into the female and, you know, it androgenizes her. And so when she's born, she can't reproduce when she, you know, hits puberty. She essentially has PCOS. She has really high libido because of the fact that she's never able to like turn over her estrous cycle into the progesterone dominant phase. And wow. So I asked my friend, I was like, hey, by any chance did your twins, because I knew one was a boy and one was a girl, share a placenta? And she said, they did. And she said, there was actually triplets in there. The third one didn't make it, but they were both boys. Whoa. And so I was like, I think that that's the cause of why your daughter, despite being raised just like her brother, always had like different outwards metabolic and, you know, endocrinology symptoms. And wow. She was like, oh my gosh, like it doesn't fix the problem now, but she will be so relieved to know that it's not her, it's her brother's fault. And that, you know, like there was a route for this that was like beyond their control. And so I thought that was really cool how my knowledge of the Fremont syndrome in animals was able to like finally give this person a diagnosis when she was like 30 years old.
Oh my gosh. That is, again, the second coolest thing. I feel like we need to just like consult together. This is so fascinating. And again, you know, some of the studies that we know about humans like PCOS, we know just like in men that exposure to endocrine disruptors that lower testosterone in men can affect, you know, their urogenital spacing, basically like it's a thing that just talks about male reproduction, but the distance between their rectum and their penis and stuff, but that changes a lot. They can have undescended testes. They can have all of these things when they're little, but you know, I don't know how many people have followed them long-term into their adulthood to see how many are struggling with fertility, but I would venture to guess many of them have. But on the female side, that same exposure to endocrine disruptors, especially the androgen type endocrine disruptors like the phthalates, have been implicated in PCOS because of, just like you said, that androgen, androgens are like the testosterones and the DHEAs, but that androgen exposure in utero, when everything is very sensitive and very you know, delicate and exposure to things, can impact that metabolic trajectory. Because we know in the animal world that PCOS is so rooted in metabolic dysfunction, insulin imbalance, things like that. But there's often an androgen component. And again, it's like we need to be taking that knowledge that you could learn and extrapolate from animals into humans and things like this to start to understand this physiology. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think we're just so many years behind that. But I personally believe, because everyone's like, why are all these infertility things happening? Why does everyone have this? I think a lot of it is toxins and food, you know, and we can learn a lot about that from the animal world. And so that is so cool. I had no idea about that. But it makes sense based on what I know about the physiology of PCOS. It just highlights it even more. And maybe there are human studies on a bunch of boy-girl twins and shared placentas and PCOS, but probably not. Like, I don't know. That's so random and specific, but also can be extrapolated to help so many people in such a big way.
Yeah, I mean, usually, you know, human twins do not share a placenta like that, but they can. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know. It's just so
cool.
Amazing how smart people are and how much humans know, but also like how little we know at the same time.
It's just understanding physiology. And I think, you know, in root cause medicine, when you're trying to get to the root cause, so much of it is understanding physiology, because you might not have a double-blind placebo-controlled trial with thousands and thousands of people to understand this very specific thing. But if you can understand physiology, and nutritional physiology is so powerful, and understanding how it works on a cellular level, and you can really solve things without waiting for the science to catch up, that can't always test it because lifestyle medicine is so complicated. There are so many variables, like you mentioned. And so, I don't know. I just think it's so cool. And I think there's so much that we can learn. And so to pull back, I have one more question about your technology that I know a lot of people are probably thinking, and I want to ask before we wrap up, which is, how is your technology different than PGT testing? So when you go through IVF, a lot of people are offered the option to do PGT testing, where they actually... Well, I guess you can explain it and go into it, but some people choose not to because it is invasive. You keep saying a non-invasive technology. Explain for people a little bit what that means and the difference between PGT and where your technology might be more beneficial, especially if people are afraid of damaging embryos or things like that.
Sure. So PGT, pre-implantation genetic testing, it's literally that. It's a genetic test on cells. So to get those cells from the embryo, you have to go in there and biopsy those cells. So you take a laser, you cut, you know, 3 to 10 cells out of that embryo. You freeze the remaining embryo, which has just been chopped up a little bit, mm-hmm. while you wait for the genetic test on those cells to come back. And being a genetic test, it is very accurate. It's very precise. You can see the different, you know, chromosomal abnormalities that embryo may possess. There is a problem called mosaicism, which is like the difference in the genetics of the cells and the trophectoderm and the inner cell mass, which is basically the difference between the placenta and the fetus. That's a different problem that we probably don't have time to go into, but it gives you genetic results if these embryos are chromosomally normal or abnormal. And a lot of these abnormal conditions are actually not compatible with life. Or if these, you know, children are born with that condition, they're going to have a much lower quality of life, which is why people choose to go through this PGT testing in the first place. It's not without risk. You're literally biopsying that embryo. And I've read studies where pregnancy rates of PGT did increase because you're, you know, selecting the genetically ideal embryos, but also miscarriage rates of PGT also increased. So the take-home baby rate really did not change with the use of PGT.
Interesting.
Our technology, we're not genetic testing. We're testing the embryo dynamics as a function of metabolism on those embryos. So we're not cutting any cells out of it. We're just taking a 30-second video with the microscope that people already have in their IVF labs and look at these embryos all day long. And then we use a machine learning analysis on these embryos based on our history of tracking embryos through pregnancy, because it's our goal to predict embryos that make babies, not even pregnancies. Like, we want to make babies. Mm-hmm. And so that's what our models have been trained on. And then we've been studying their real-time activity to make further inferences. So what we've actually seen in human embryos is there's different activity patterns of these embryos in euploid versus aneuploid embryos. I cannot tell you that aneuploid embryo, I cannot tell you, like, pinpoint the genetic condition that it has. I don't know that it's, you know, Down syndrome or, you know, any other syndrome, but I can tell you that it's behaving abnormality, and perhaps you should probably select the normal behaving embryos first, because those are more relevant to a chromosomally normal embryo. And I was able to get this information because a lot of the videos that we took were on the embryo before they went through PGT. Mm-hmm. And so we actually got to combine our analysis with their PGT outcomes to know if the embryos we were looking at were normal or abnormal.
That is so cool. You're so cool. I'm so excited about this. So for anyone who wants to learn more, how can people get involved, learn more? Is this something, are you ready to go into IVF clinics? Can people ask their IVF clinic for this? Is it not at that stage yet? If people want to get involved with investing, or I don't even know, like, where are you at? Like, how do you want people to connect with you or check you out or tell us all the things?
So yes, we currently have about 5 clinics that are using this for research only. They're not making decisions off of it. And we are asking people with informed consent to participate in our research, which you would be allowing us to take a 30-second video of these embryos and then allowing us to track your follow-up pregnancy outcomes or any information that this clinic would routinely ask you for about the outcomes of that embryo. I can send a list of these 5 clinics with you, but we're accepting more clinics. And so if this is something that you'd be interested in working with us on, you can reach out to me. I can send you a 1-pager that you can give to your lab or your REI for how they can get involved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they agree, then we'd love to have you participate, or else I can give you referral information to some of the labs that we're already working with. And we have a website, mgenesis.co. It has cows all over it, but we are working on the launch of Viable Biosciences, which will be the human IVF division of our company. And then reaching out to me directly via email or on LinkedIn works quite well.
Amazing. I'll put all of those links in the show notes. And this has been such an amazing and fascinating chat. I'm so glad that we got to do this. And thank you so much for giving up such a big chunk of your day to chat with me.
I had fun. Thank you so much.
Of course. If your heart aches for a baby, whether you're dreaming of motherhood someday or you're already on the path and it hasn't been going as you imagined, I want you to know that you do not have to do this alone. Consider joining me inside of my Womanhood Wellness membership. You get a custom blueprint unique to your womanescence type, which is where you are right now on the journey. You have access to all of my courses and content, which includes how to boost egg and sperm quality, the energetics of fertility, investigating fertility, optimizing IVF if that's a path you have to go down, navigating pregnancy loss. I have my Essential Foundations course where you learn all the things that you really need to know to have a thriving hormonal and fertility system. You learn the Hormone Handbook where I dive deep into all the different hormonal imbalances and what you can do naturally to rebalance them. I have deep dive courses on vaginal microbiome, in detoxing, on mindset. I give you my natural medicine protocols. You have the ability to order labs on your own. You get discounts on supplements and other products. I have organized the community by your season. So if you are breaking up with birth control, you can jump in a chat with women in that exact same season. If you are trying to conceive, or if you are going through pregnancy loss or infertility or IVF or low libido, there is a group of women who are going through the same thing. We also have full community areas like our breakfast club, where every Monday we share what we're having for breakfast to inspire each other, and our daily flow, where we connect as a collective community and do challenges and learn from each other in that way. On top of all of that, I do a monthly live Q&A where you can bring your questions and they're always recorded so you can listen if you can't make them live. And then I have various calls with other practitioners like Sadie, our amazing personal development coach, and so many others where you will be able to receive healing and learn other perspectives. Being a member inside Womanhood Wellness also gives you discounts to join my upcoming immersions. Take around 22 women for a month to dive deep into a specific topic like decoding desire or building your dream life or navigating painful periods or navigating unexplained infertility. This is the place that you want to be if you want to know all of the natural root cause and supportive measures that you can take to optimize your womanhood journey and your path to and through motherhood. Head to womanhoodwellness.com and use code podcast to save 20% off your first month. I can't wait to see you inside. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with a friend who would benefit from this content. Please remember that the views and ideas from this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis and treatment of any disease. Consult with your provider before integrating any of this information into your own healthcare plan. A healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.